And we're back here in Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton, Ontario at 93.3 on the FM dial and the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca, our online streaming service. We're very pleased today. I promised last week we'd have a special guest, and we do. It is all the way from Australia, Professor Tim Anderson. He is the author of The Dirty War on Syria, Washington Regime Change and Resistance. Now, Dr. Tim Anderson is a senior lecturer in political economy at the University of Sydney. He researches and writes on development, rights, and self-determination in Latin America, Asia Pacific, and the Middle East. He has published many dozens of chapters and articles in a range of academic books and journals, and his last book was Land and Livelihoods in Papua New Guinea. So, Professor Anderson, thanks very much for being on the program with us today.
Thank you, Brendan.
We've caught you all the way in Australia because of the importance of this book, The Dirty War on Syria, that you just recently came out with and that you can purchase online at Global Research, www.globalresearch.ca. A very important book, as I say. Just when I started reading it last week, I noted right away, I think it seems that you are a disciple of Philip Knightley, the author of Truth, The First Casualty of War. That was a book that got me into anti-war activism. I mean, that was a book that talked about how governments and empires manufacture propaganda to get people to accept wars, especially overseas wars of aggression. So I'm really impressed that Philip Knightley seemed to play a role in inspiring your book. Now, it's divided into the A story of what really happened in Syria, the events, the factual account, and then the B and C story, what the U.S. media, Western media, what the U.S. State Department kept changing its story to be on the issue of Syria. And in contrast to those stories, what you wrote is calmly written and expressed logically, very much unlike the sensationalist propaganda we've been subjected to since 2011 or so, this war propaganda, this abandonment of all principles of journalism and objectivity. And that's what chapters one and two are about, introducing the topic. And there's a lot of repetition of tired statements when you're looking at our propaganda, like, Assad has lost all legitimacy, or the use of profoundly biased sources and a lack of independent investigation. Some of those things tie very much together. Syrian Observatory for Human Rights is a group you look at, and its role in propaganda, as well as the recycling of war dead. I was wondering if you could start out with perhaps that somewhat gruesome topic to get a sense of just how misleading some of the things are. There was a recycling in the media and propaganda about people who had been killed in combat and conflicts in Syria, in the case of Aleppo, or even when al-Nusra killed Syria's senior Quranic scholar after threatening to kill him and then blamed it on the government. I'm wondering if you could tell us about this kind of incidents like that, where there's a sort of grisly use of casualties and victims or recycling of people who had been killed in the war.
Thank you, Brendan. Yeah, I think any war propaganda, and we have to learn from previous conflicts, don't we? That was why the reference to Philip Knightley, who's Australian, by the way, but he went to work in Britain for a lot of his life. That repetition of accusations demonizing the other side, a constant one-sided narrative of a war, you can construct any sort of meaning in people's minds if there is control of the media. And it's what astonished me most about this war, the one on Syria, is the incredible control, despite the fact that there's more possibilities on the internet than there's ever been before, despite the fact that people are more formally educated than they've been before, but this constant repetition, as you say, of those same sort of narratives that Assad is the new Hitler and is killing children and so on, that the constant repetition of those things does get into people's minds. And, well, some of the examples of the recycling of images, I mean, in some recent incidents, we saw that one of the villages that's under siege in Syria, Madaya, just recently, the corporate media around the world trotted out pictures of children from all sorts of different contexts. They had rallies from Yarmouk camp, which had been under a siege when al-Nusra and later ISIS moved in there. So they'd recycled images from all over the place. Human Rights Watch director Kenneth Rock was using pictures from Kobani, where ISIS had attacked a Kurdish town, to show supposedly Assad's barrel bomb attacks on Aleppo. The same man from Human Rights Watch had showed pictures from Gaza after an Israeli attack to try and illustrate supposed Assad bombing of his opponents or civilians. The constant reference to the al-Qaeda groups themselves as civilians, this is something that was going on from the beginning, and it led the Melkite nun, Mary, Mother Agnes Mariam, to, back in 2011, to start saying, let's stop talking about numbers of people dead, give me names, because she had observed back in Homs in 2011 that the Islamist groups at that time were dressing up their own dead as civilians and recycling photographs and recycling numbers of dead back at that time. It was a common tactic back then. So it's been a very important tactic of the Islamist groups and their Western backers, and to keep this strong cycle of civilians are being targeted, civilians are being targeted by the Syrian army, so that the Syrian state itself would be delegitimized, so that people would back any type of brutal, extreme actions against the Syrian army, the Syrian government, basically. And to a large extent, it worked, I think. I was astonished to see how it did work, how incredibly homogenous in many respects the Western media were in this dirty war.
Yes. It's very cynical that people would use people who had been killed in various actions, recycle them in numerous ways. And yet your book contains numerous such examples that are documented, even with photographic evidence, and the repetition of this kind of narrative. And what's really unfortunate here is that we've been told for the last 10 years or so that we live in a world of new media, social media networks like Facebook and Twitter and all sorts of things via the internet that enable us to have a supposed democratization of information. And yet, as you clearly point out throughout the book, we're getting a very unified narrative, one that is lacking in diversity, and one that is also very inaccurate. And I'm glad that your book is able to do this, and that it's also unfortunate that we don't have the kind of diversity of information that we're supposed to in this information age. But I guess to look at why there's a lot of misleading information about Syria, we should step back a bit. You had investigated in the early part of your book why the United States wants regime change in Syria, because that is an issue or a factor that is often missing from analysis, and especially the emotionally heated kind of imagery that appears on social media. So the United States has objectives with regard to Syria. And I'm wondering if you could tell us what you discovered about the United States' position vis-a-vis the government in Syria.
Well, yeah, it goes back a very long way to the wars in 1967, 1973 with Israel. And the position that Syria has taken in respect to Israel, and that is to say not having a peace agreement, not agreeing to surrender territory that the Israelis had annexed in the northern part of Israel, in the Golan Heights, which Israel still occupies in contravention of international law. So that objective has been around for a long time. Syria also had a long-term relationship with the old Soviet Union. And you can go back and find at least, and there's no doubt there's earlier examples than this, but I mentioned one in the book, a cable from 1980 where they're discussing the possibilities of regime change in Syria when the president was Hafez al-Assad back at that time, and wondering about what the reaction of the Soviet Union would be at that time. Interesting, of course, because now, fast forward to late 2015, and you have that Russian intervention in Syria, which was, of course, what the US had feared all along with the Soviet Union, and has now come about. Basically, effectively, militarily, the tide has turned because of the air power that Russia has brought to Syria in September 2015. Also, let's remember when we say that it's also the fact that the U.S. U.S.-led assault on Syria, you know, it's mainly through its allies, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and Qatar, also Israel, has had the effect of bringing together the partners in that region, that is to say Syria, which has had a strong alliance with the Islamic Republic of Iran to begin with, not based on sectarianism, because Syria is the most notably secular state in the region. But that alliance with Iran, a growing alliance with Iraq, which has implications for U.S. strategy in the region, and, of course, the better part of Lebanon, the militias organized by Hezbollah in Lebanon, that the army on the ground in Syria that's now routing the Western-backed groups, ISIS and the al-Qaeda coalition, are really the first sign we've seen of a unified region, Iraq, Iran, Syria, and Lebanon on the ground. That's really where the progress is being made with the backing of Russian air power.
Right. So Syria has not necessarily been on the same team as the United States or its regional partners, I guess you could call them. You know, the United States has undertaken various initiatives with regard to Syria. You documented some of these. You looked all the way back to the Carter administration and then the Bush administration. I'm just wondering if you could take a moment just to tell us what Carter or Bush were thinking or how they saw developments in Syria. What were they trying to do?
Sure. Well, with Carter, of course, the turning point was the revolution in Iran in 1979, which ejected what was effectively a client state of the U.S. led by the Shah for 25 years, a resented regime which crumbled, which collapsed very rapidly. I mean, fortunately, the extent of violence, the extent of killing was limited because the regime of the Shah in Iran had such little domestic support. But it was a huge shock to the U.S. back in 1979. And it never forgave Iran for that. The U.S.-backed used Saddam Hussein in an old territorial claim he had with Iran to incite that very long, bloody war between Iran and Iraq in the 1980s. And from that time onwards, the U.S. was looking for, let's say from 1979, for ways in which they could, pardon me, could leverage their power in the region. One of them was to manufacture this type of supposedly essentialist conflict between Sunni and Shia Muslims using Saudi Arabia. Now, Saudi Arabia had been a partner for the British since the First World War, when the British and the French inherited in many respects the control of the region from the old Ottoman Empire and divided it up on sectarian lines, creating the current array of states there. But the U.S. Took over, really, you might say, control of the Saudi regime from the British back in the 1950s, and then began to use it again after the Iranian Revolution to try and posit this idea of some sort of essential religious split within the region. And if you fast forward then to more recent years in the Bush administration, after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, was faced with a situation which was probably predictable, that having removed Saddam, which many Iraqis wanted, they now faced the horror, really, that Iraq was going to move naturally very closely to its biggest neighbour, Iran, not least because the majority of Iraqis are Shia, as in Iran, not as strongly as in Iran, but nevertheless, the main obstacle to good relationships between Iran and Iraq was the regime of Saddam Hussein, which Saddam had also been an enemy of Syria, despite the fact that both countries were dominated by a Ba'ath Party, a one-party state. Nevertheless, Saddam had his own ambitions and was willing to be used by the U.S. up until he decided in Washington that he was no longer a convenient tool for Washington. So the result of that was that with the Bush administration in 2005-2006, there was a move, fairly openly stated, to create what they called a new Middle East, what U.S. journalist Seymour Hersh called the redirection. And the redirection was, having having overpowered Iraq and occupied Iraq at that time, the new redirection was about trying to reshape the entire region. And that meant controlling all of the states in the region. And at that time, only Syria and Iran, they were the only countries without US bases, basically. There have been reports since then that within the Pentagon there was talk of taking over 7 countries within 5 years. I think you've seen that, that's been publicized. General Wesley Clark spoke about that at the time. And it didn't quite work out that way, but there certainly was a succession of regime change operations from Afghanistan to Iraq to Libya with the opportunity of the so-called Arab Spring of 2011, and then to Syria as in what was widely seen as a sequel to an attempt to take over Iran. Of course, things didn't go as planned, but there was indeed that idea of a grand plan. Let's not forget Israel's attempt to subjugate, take over, disarm Hezbollah, the most disciplined, organized resistance group in southern Lebanon in 2006. That failed effectively. The Israelis couldn't meet their objectives there. They lost, having suffered some fairly heavy losses. The Lebanese people suffered more heavy losses, but Hezbollah effectively was militarily strengthened at that time. That was all part of an idea that there was going to be the whole region was going to be shaped out to be really under the tutelage of the US. And so within that context, we've got the Syrian conflict after the destruction of Libya, the idea that Syria was the next domino to fall, more or less, and that would leave Iran isolated, Hezbollah isolated against Israel in Lebanon. But of course, that wasn't to be. There was far greater resistance in Syria than was envisaged.
Absolutely. I do recall news articles at the time where pundits who favor intervention were triumphantly proclaiming that Libya is down and Syria is next. You know, we're going to take this regime change express down to Syria and we're going to deal with them the way we dealt with Gaddafi. Now, of course, it hasn't turned out quite like that, but we've had to endure in the West 5 years of absolutely sensationalist reporting. You've pointed out that this is among the most inaccurate and emotionally charged reporting on any issue that anyone alive can remember when we're talking about Syria. And, you know, now that we're there in 2011, and I kind of want to talk about how this all got started with this round of conflict in Syria, because it seems that anti-government forces, and by that I mean people inside Syria as well as outside Syria, have sort of superimposed a narrative over the actual situation. You know, there's a narrative that, you know, Assad is evil dictator and everyone hates him and they're just waiting for him to go, but they need some help from outside, just put in a no-fly zone and get rid of Assad, and then all the problems in Syria will go away and it will become a U.S.-aligned democracy and will become rich like Sweden, you know, and we've heard that before. And, of course, that narrative did not really relate to the actual situation. I'm wondering if you could maybe start by telling us about how the violence started, because the official story is that, you know, peaceful protesters were shot at by the army, and then those peaceful protesters became these hardened Islamic militants within a few days. So I'm wondering if you could tell us about the early part of this in 2011.
Yes, so that's what first attracted my attention. I remember reading about the violence in Daraa, and I was wondering, where did this come from? Because really, back at that time, I only had, a good general knowledge about Syria. But I had some understanding of interventions and also street demonstrations and violence, and it doesn't just come out of thin air. So I started reading about Daraa in particular and about Syrian history. And it turns out, of course, that Syria, well, you don't have to look very far to find that Syrian history has a history of insurrections by the Muslim Brotherhood. What's the Muslim Brotherhood? It's a group that was set up in the 1940s in Egypt to try and, on the one hand, with anti-colonial focus, but also a very strong competitive streak, competitive against Arab nationalism. Now, Arab nationalism, historically, we know, was the great liberating force in the Middle East between the 1940s and, let's say, the 1970s or 80s. But the Islamic, an attempt to create a type of sectarian Islamic counterpart to that Arab nationalism, which failed in Egypt, it failed in Syria, but nevertheless led to a number of sectarian uprisings, both in, particularly in Egypt and Syria, also in Palestine and other parts of the Middle East, but it had been strongest in Egypt and Syria. So there'd been, for example, a series of insurrections in Syria in the late 70s, early 80s, leading up to the the final failed insurrection in Hama, so almost 30 years before 2011. In Hama, there was a violent insurrection, sectarian, because they aimed at killing minorities and as well as trying to topple the government. It was put down by the late President Hafez al-Assad within a few weeks. Several thousand people were killed. The number's been inflated in the mythology since then, but several thousand were killed there and parts of Hama were razed. Now, the modus operandi, if you like, of that insurrection was incredibly similar to Dara, incredibly similar to Dara. And we know now, because of what's come out about Dara, we knew within a few months, that the Saudis had armed Islamists around the Al-Omari Mosque. Now, so just to be clear, there's two things going on here. There was a genuine political reform movement in Syria at that time. It was influenced by regional events there, but you can take the regional influences too far because each of those countries involved in the so-called Arab Spring, Egypt and Tunisia and Libya and Syria, were quite different countries. There were different things going on in Egypt to what was going on in Syria. But there was this level of street demonstration. There were all, in the Syrian context, there were also very strong counter-demonstrations, pro-government demonstrations at that time. So there was a street demonstration culture going on at the time. And under cover of that, a quite distinct process, an Islamist insurrection led by Syrian Salafis. Salafis are the sectarian groups within within Sunni Islam. They don't by no means represent Sunni Islam. Salafism is this type of sectarianism that comes from the Gulf and particularly from the Saudis. That violent insurrection was taking place, taking cover of the street demonstrations back in the middle of March 2011. And elements of that were reported at the time, but they were also actively suppressed. For example, the television channel Al Jazeera, run from Qatar in the Gulf, actively suppressed these stories, for example, of foreign jihadis flocking to Syria to join that insurrection from Tripoli in northern Lebanon, for example, through to Homs, for example. But even in Dara and in March, in the middle of March, and the book reconstructs what was happening, the killings that were going on at that time. In Dara, the violence began initially from snipers from the roof. The snipers were killing both police and civilians, and also medical workers who were coming in to aid the injured people to there. So it was what seemed like a random violence at the time. It wasn't definitive link to the government, but the Western media and the Islamist groups began to insistently accuse the government of it. But it was illogical because there were police and security forces being killed. The Syrian government itself suppressed the numbers of deaths because it was trying to keep a handle on the impact of those deaths and the panic that might result. But when we go back and reconstruct what was happening there, even if you look at that whole period of 2011, before we look at particular incidents in 2011, in that first year, which is really the only year that the United Nations kept a casualty toll at the time, there was around 5,000 deaths in 2011. Half of them, according to the United Nations, were police and security forces. Yet, if we looked at the narrative coming from the US, for example, from Human Rights Watch and from the White House, and in this respect, because Human Rights Watch is very closely aligned to the Democrat side of politics in the US, they were really in lockstep with the Syrian narrative. Their narrative was that there was no serious violence from the peaceful protesters' side until several months later, until September 2011. Now, if you look at it closely, that's contradicted by all sorts of independent witnesses at the time, including the funerals of military people and so on, all the way through 2011. So there's a very serious divergence in the narrative of the violence in Syria in 2011. If you've got the patience, if you've got the time, you can go and look it up and find the evidence for yourself, and I've tried to document this in the book. But publicly, if you didn't have the time to do that, if you were just reading the news sources that you relied on as normal, you would be thoroughly misled about what was going on in Syria in 2011.
Absolutely. In Canada, certainly, we had a very similar narrative to what you would have been hearing in Australia, which is that, you know, there were these peaceful protesters and the government attacked them. But as you pointed out, and you're using documented information, you're looking at like media reports from the Gulf press, from Syrian press, from international press, you're looking at UN accounts, you're looking at other accounts. It's all there in the documentation. There were people that had attacked police or government forces using weapons. And you also noted, as was admitted later, that the Saudi Arabian government shipped in arms, shipped in weapons to these people that are called protesters. So they shipped in weapons, which were used to attack government employees, and then the military was brought in after the violence against government workers.
Yes, that's right. That was the logic of what was going on at that time. And the Saudis openly admitted it, basically. So that was the... In fact, there were arms intercepted before the violence began on the Iraqi border, coming through the Iraqi border. Eventually that was addressed by the Iraqi government, but even before the violence began, there were reports of arms being seized at that time. But the Western narrative led by the White House was that the armed resistance to the Syrian government came from defecting soldiers, which created something called the Free Syrian Army, which never really existed as an army, but really it was a way of funneling funds and arms into the various particular groups. That really emerged spontaneously from the Syrian context. It wasn't spontaneous at all. There were, of course, Syrian Salafist groups linked to old Muslim Brotherhood networks. The Muslim Brotherhood was part of the Syrian opposition. Here's another thing that the Western narrative reconstructed. There was indeed a Syrian opposition. There is a Syrian opposition, political opposition, particularly to the Ba'ath Party. More to the Ba'ath Party, by the way, than to President Bashar al-Assad, because although President Assad was effectively conscripted by the Ba'ath Party to the presidency when his father died, he had and he maintains a level of support somewhat broader than that party. And that party, there's a lot of complaints about that party for corruption, nepotism, and no one really liked the secret police back in civil times when there wasn't a war going on. I think the attitude to the secret police has changed somewhat with the war, basically. But the Syrian sectarians at that time got support very quickly from outside, from the Saudis, but also from jihadis coming from other countries. And those foreign jihadis are the ones that created the group called Jabhat al-Nusra, which is, its long name is really the support front for the Islamic people of Syria. So it was always constructed as a support front for the Syrian Islamists, if you like, basically. So that process was really hidden by most of the Western media and the insistent repetition of their themes. Later on, of course, initially it was that there was a secular revolution. Then it was that there was a sectarian regime, even though the Islamists were complaining about the Syrian government, because it was secular and therefore not truly religious. It was apostate because there was a man who was from a minority group that was, did not represent true Islam and so on. So the pretext for the intervention in Syria have kept changing. But once the latest one is that the government has been indiscriminately attacking civilians and now is starving civilians in these sieges. Of course, the new phase of the military era, if you like, in the Syrian war is that the government is starving civilians through sieges. In fact, what's happening is they're cutting off blocks of ISIS and al-Qaeda fighters, and indeed there is a siege, and there are aid operations going on for the civilians affected by those sorts of siege. The Islamists are using civilians as human shields, but once again we're getting a completely one-sided story of what the what's actually happening in Syria.
Of course. Now, for those who are just tuning in, we are speaking with Professor Tim Anderson. He is the author of The Dirty War on Syria, Washington Regime Change and Resistance, which you can purchase online at Global Research, www.globalresearch.ca. I believe it's about 9 U.S. dollars, and you can purchase it and have it instantly and start reading it right away. Now, in your book, now you documented a number of cases where armed insurgents were labeled as protesters and were included in the civilian death count, or how civilian deaths were dressed up as casualties of the government, all sorts of things like that. People can tune into your book, Chapter 1, 2, 3, and get that sort of information. You've pointed out the recycling of war debt a number of times. Again, a very gruesome and grisly thing. And now you're talking about the conflict, the political conflicts that had occurred in Syria. Now, we were given this Arab Spring narrative, and certainly what happened in Syria occurred at that time. But the reforms and the political context extended long before that. I mean, in the pre-conflict period, you could date it all the way back to the turn of the millennium, around the year 2000. Bashar al-Assad assumed office, and there had been a reform period of the early 2000s. I understand that was ongoing, although it became more and more fragmented. I'm wondering if you could tell us what challenges did the government and Syria in general experience during this period of reform?
Yes, well, you have to recognize that there was a genuine political reform movement. It wasn't led by the al-Qaeda groups. It was led by a number of people who, when the violence broke out, essentially aligned with the state, if some with the government, but a lot more with the state. That is to say, there was at its peak, let's say, in 2005, I mean, you're right to say that Bashar al-Assad was seen as a reform candidate when he, as quite a young man at 35, came to the presidency in 2000, conscripted by the Ba'ath Party on the death of his family. He was seen as a force for reform, and indeed did bring about a number of social and economic reforms at that time, opened up the country in many respects, while keeping the secularism that his and the inclusiveness that his father had developed. So he was seen as more or less building on his father's legacy. But there were hopes for greater openings, and there were people frustrated with the limits of the reform in the early 2000s. And you had this thing called the Damascus Declaration in 2005, which still remains the most comprehensive statement of the Syrian political opposition at that time. And it's quite interesting because it's quite critical of the government, particularly critical of the Ba'athist monopoly, the one-party system that had been created. But it wanted to preserve a lot of elements that one-party system had created, the secularism, the support for a national army, for example, the social inclusiveness, the free education and health, those sorts of things. So that Damascus Declaration was notable because it specifically rejected foreign-supported opposition elements and any armed attacks on the army or the institutions of the state. Now, of course, that's exactly what happened with the Muslim Brotherhood-led insurrection in 2011. And that's why you can trace all of those other opposition groups going within a very short space of time with the insurrection in 2011, siding back with the state. And I've spoken to a number of those people, like in political parties like the Syrian Social National Party, but also ordinary people who took part in those demonstrations wanting reforms in 2011. And they switched back to the government or to the state very rapidly in that period between March and, let's say, June 2011, when they saw it was taken over by a Salafist armed insurrection. That was ignored in the West because what was spoken about as the quote-unquote the opposition these days remains the al-Qaeda groups linked up to the Muslim Brotherhood, basically. In Geneva, for example, you hear Secretary of State John Kerry talking about the opposition. He's talking about the al-Qaeda Muslim Brotherhood linked groups that had their summit meeting in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. He's not talking about the civil opposition that in the middle of 2011 went back and took the parliamentary route, took the supporting the state route at that time against the Islamists. So there's a very different perception as to what the Syrian opposition is in Syria and in North America, for example.
Yes, it's very unfortunate that the foreign involvement by a number of extremist fighters and then by great powers has had this kind of negative impact on what should be a Syrian domestic process. And it's kind of ironic because you've pointed out in the book that, you know, rather than being simply a tyrant or a strongman, Syrians seem to view Bashar al-Assad as a kind of weak or soft leader because, number one, his slow actions and kind of a failure at the immediate stage to address the armed insurgency, but also the slowness in the reforms. Some people were thinking they were too gentle. So he seemed that he had a soft touch, and that was upsetting the population.
Yes, so they had. I mean, the first time I went to Syria, I visited Syria twice during the conflict. And in 2013, a number of people mentioned this phrase, which translates Mr. Softheart. They liked him as a person, but he really was and is, as he appears, a mild-mannered eye doctor who was conscripted to being a politician. He wasn't an ambitious politician who clawed his way up. He was conscripted by the party to continue his father's legacy, but he was a mild-mannered man. He wasn't a Saddam Hussein or a George W. Bush. Not a brute by any means in his demeanour. When he spoke to us in 2013, an Australian delegation in Syria, the thing I remember most strongly was he was concerned about the impact on children of seeing people being publicly murdered, having their throats slit in public, while others were dancing around chanting "God is great, Allahu Akbar." You know, he said, "How do you deal with that type of cultural impact on children?" So this is the sort of person he is. And you're right that people were frustrated on the one hand with the pace of reform, but also when the violence broke out, they thought that he was Mr. Softheart was less experienced. He didn't have a firm hand to put it down quickly, as his father had done in Hama. So there was that type of criticism there. And behind that, for example, there were some practical things. Like I discovered in 2013, there was an army order to make all efforts to take any Syrian combatants alive because there was a chance of rehabilitating them and, you know, the idea of avoiding the bitterness with their family if they were simply eliminated as combatant terrorists. Now, that was and probably is still controversial in Syria because the distinction between foreign terrorists and Syrian terrorists is something that a number of Syrians say they are as judgmental or severe on the Syrian terrorists as the foreign ones because they regard them as traitors. They're the people, for example, the Syrians that allow the al-Qaeda groups into certain areas that betray people because the groups come in and murder the sons of the families, of Syrian families there. So a number of Syrians are not inclined to be very forgiving of Syrians who betray them to the al-Qaeda Islamists, basically. And yet there is this reconciliation project which Bashar al-Assad has had in place since 2011 to this day to try and recruit, you know, from one side to the other those people to, the expression in Syria is, to normalize their legal status, that these people, if there isn't blood on their hands, if they've helped the Islamist groups, they can register and have a type of pardon, if you like, to reincorporate themselves into life in Syria. Yes. And that process has been going on for several years. It's going to accelerate with the current surrenders of the Islamist groups there. So it's true that Bashar is seen in a very different sort of way in Syria to the way he's been turned into this sort of cartoon figure of the new Hitler of the 21st century outside Syria.
Well, one of the things about Western propaganda is that they just sort of create an image without regard to how it corresponds to what's happening in that country. So you have the evil Assad, his name becomes the whole country, and, you know, we're just supposed to get rid of him, and he is, as you say, a cartoon villain in our reporting, which necessitates books like your own. And certainly there has been, against all the difficulties involved, the Syrian government has been trying to go through with these processes of what you might call truth and reconciliation and sort of demobilize militants and incorporate them back into Syria, one Syria. And it's very difficult with the sort of fanaticism that they're against. You traced in Chapter 5 the major political currents in the Middle East and how they helped create conditions for a sectarian political opposition to emerge in Syria, and how some of these organized currents often collaborated and still do collaborate with imperialism. I'm thinking the U.S. in particular. You documented the Muslim Brotherhood and Wahhabis and how they interact with great powers and so on. It's very intriguing. People can read about it in the chapter. We don't have time to go into it here, but what I was hoping maybe you could tell us a little bit about where this idea of a free Syrian army comes from, and maybe how some of the writing and reporting on this has obscured the sectarian nature of these groups when they're engaged in an armed insurgency.
Yes, well, there never has been a Free Syrian Army per se. It was a name coined to say there wasn't a command of a Free Syrian Army. There was a type of a quartermaster role given to certain and some of them were indeed defectors from the Syrian army, the Syrian Arab army, which is a very big army. But you found then, for example, the people who were supposedly commanders of the Free Syrian Army were really quartermasters for the coordination of arms and funds supplied to a number of different groups that had their own names. The biggest group that was allied to the Free Syrian Army in 2011 was a group called the Farouk Brigade. It was an Islamist group, but it was... And it was the one that took over parts of Homs city in late 2011 with Jabhat al-Nusra, with the official al-Qaeda in Syria. That is to say, they're foreign supporters. And their foreign supporters came largely from Lebanon and Jordan back in those days before the big surge of foreign jihadis that came through Turkey in 2011. Really, after the Syrian Islamists were defeated in Homs, historically, that's more or less what happened, that there was this very large group of Syrian Salafis backed by foreigners from Lebanon and Jordan that tried to occupy Homs city and succeeded to a certain extent. They remained in part of the city until quite recently, but effectively most of them were defeated and driven out of the city in 2012, and that's when a new wave of jihadis came in, a lot of them from North Africa, from Libya with arms and fighters from Libya and Tunisia in 2011 because of the policy developed by the Turkish President Erdogan in 2012. He saw advantage for himself in that circumstance. So there was a type of a historical development of the conflict over a period of time, but the Free Syrian Army in that context was really more a coordination point between a range of different groups. At one stage, I think the Pentagon was talking about hundreds of groups. I'm not sure about hundreds. Certainly there was dozens of groups. You can identify dozens of different groups. These days, they're down. They really coalesced into a number of groups, which in 2016 we can identify as Jaish al-Islam, the Islamic Army, the Islamic Front, and that brought together a number of the old groups that were under the banner of the Free Syrian Army, and Arar al-Sham, which is another Islamist group, basically. They were all Islamist groups. There weren't ever any substantial secular or non-Islamist groups there, but they had a range of different names. Farouk, which effectively disintegrated, but they were the biggest one in 2011. They were the ones that went into Homs city in the middle of 2011, and you've got chanting genocidal slogans. The most famous slogan was Christians to Beirut, Alawis to the tomb. So in other words, the idea that they were going to, and they in fact did, drive Christians out of Homs to Lebanon and kill Alawis, kill the minority apostate Muslims. So that slogan was reported in the US media as early at least as May 2011. Yet you find a year later on a number of specialist think tanks and media still saying that Farouk were either secular or they were pious Sunnis, but not Islamists. When they'd used and been reported as using genocidal slogans, and then in that same year, a Christian press itself was reporting the ethnic cleansing of at least 50,000 Christians from Homs to Lebanon. So that sort of ethnic cleansing was going on while that dominant group of the so-called Free Syrian Army was being portrayed as either pious Sunnis or secular people for at least a year in the Western media. That same Western media had reported those genocidal slogans, the genocidal practice of that group in Homs.
Now, didn't that Al-Farouk battalion engage in some kind of attack on a hospital or something like that?
There were some well-publicized destructions of hospitals and that were well-publicized. They filmed their own bombing of those hospitals. They'd really, the approach of the Islamists was to destroy, take them over the hospitals if they could, destroy them if they'd been treating soldiers. Indeed, a lot of the hospitals were treating soldiers because, again, contrary to the Western media narrative, a large number of the people being killed in the conflict in the early years and still were Syrian soldiers. So, of course, a lot of the hospitals were receiving lots of soldiers. So, for example, a hospital in Qusair, hospitals in Homs, hospital in Aleppo were being systematically demolished. They were defended by the Syrian army, but when they were taken over by Islamists, they would demolish them. When I got to Syria in late 2013, the health minister gave an Australian group a briefing and pointed out what I hadn't known before, which was the systematic nature of that. They're in the book, it's something like 67 hospitals out of 94 national hospitals had been destroyed or damaged by attacks by the armed groups. So then at that point I realised there'd been a systematic campaign to take out these hospitals, not just occasional hospitals being blown up, but really quite systematic. And, the murder of health workers, several thousand health workers, they were working for the government. They were treating everyone, including soldiers, and they were killed for that reason. Back in 2011, 2012, we've got many, many examples of the Islamists at that time killing people, not because simply because they were in minorities, but because they were working for the government. There's one gruesome video of post workers in a post office being murdered by being thrown off, or murdered and thrown off the top of the building in Aleppo, I believe. So you've got a lot of these sorts of anecdotes well before ISIS comes across from Iraq into Syria. ISIS was ISI in al-Qaeda in Iraq before the Syrian war began, and it became ISIS later on.
Yes, a lot of the opposition elements resembled in character ISIS before ISIS officially emerged. And when they would kill government employees, often this was excused in our own media. They would say, well, these were regime personnel, regime employees, regime neighborhoods. And that's the last part I wanted to just bring up here. And that is just, again, the media reporting on things like this. For when Al-Farouk or others attacked hospitals, it was often portrayed as the government attacking hospitals. So people would go on Facebook and they would say, well, Assad blew up this hospital. Oh, that damn Assad, we got to get rid of him. And again, changing what's happening on the ground. Now, we have an added component here that's been a staple of U.S. military practice for the last 30 years or so, and that is the inclusion of Western-based and Western-headquartered human rights organizations. In this case, campaigning for things like a no-fly zone. I'm wondering if you could tell us a bit about that.
Yes, that's been another notable feature of this conflict, that the online activism, if you could say, online groups or activists, a lot of it, there's been two currents of it, really, in support of the war in Syria. One has been from the Islamists themselves. They have some quite sophisticated groups, and Farouk, for example, when they were committing atrocities, they were filming them and sending them to Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya. Al Jazeera run by Qatar, Al Arabiya run by Saudi Arabia. They were filming those atrocities, sending them to the Gulf TV channels, and they were being run as reports of atrocities by government troops. So this became quite systematic. Then you have these groups, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is one man based in England, with the protection of British intelligence. Being a ubiquitous source of body count data in the Syrian conflict, several other groups allied to the Islamists that were really sources of information, sources of supposed human rights abuses by the Syrian regime. At the same time, you've got the funding of a number of what you could call Wall Street groups, because they do indeed literally come from Wall Street. There was a pre-existing group called Avaaz, funded by George Soros's Open Society Foundation, and a number of subgroups created under that. Some are called the White Helmets, the Syria Campaign, a series of those sorts of groups, plus Human Rights Watch, which was a longer-standing group created in the late 70s during the Cold War, specifically to focus on the supposed human rights abuses of the old Soviet Union. Those groups more or less working hand in glove with this campaign, as you say, for a no-fly zone, which we know since the Libyan conflict means NATO intervention, NATO air intervention in the conflict, basically.
Yes, so I think some members of these groups were so enthusiastic about a no-fly zone. They were saying, you know, a no-fly zone may not even be enough, or we need to do it now. It actually prompted critique from other people who study human rights that they were saying it's highly irresponsible for human rights organizations to be calling for what they know will be military airstrikes or armed military great power conflict in another country.
The unusual thing about this is that contrary to the older idea that you've got hawks and doves on the western side of a conflict like this, where the hawks being the more aggressive people, when you've got a war that's posited as a humanitarian war, as this one has been in Syria, you find the liberal side of politics coming in more strongly in favour of it. So the liberal media, for example, in the US context, the Democrat Party, in the British media context, newspapers like The Guardian, The Independent, but including the BBC, are the ones that are most strongly in favour of so-called humanitarian intervention. So you've got an alliance between what you might call the realists or the conservatives, who typically they support the government line and support direct interests, so US interests in the world, you know, the advancement of the military to advance US interests in the world, but also the liberals that had this humanitarian idea. So in Syria, in many respects, the aggression has been driven by the liberal side of politics, and, well, it's no coincidence that there's a Democrat regime in Washington for both the Libyan and the Syrian interventions.
Yes. Well, your Chapter 6 on the media and the human rights group is chock full of information about all of these groups, who they are, who funds them, who chairs them, what is their relationship with the Pentagon and the White House. And it's just staggering when you actually read about it. It should be required reading at universities and international relations classes. But, you know, I mean, we're run out of time for this week. What I would like to do, if we have a chance next week, is to catch up on some of the other broader issues you bring up in this very exciting book. I was wondering maybe if just you could take a moment to tell us. I was intrigued by something you wrote, I believe, towards the beginning of the book, when you said that it had given you, the process of writing the book had given you a greater respect for pious people, for religious people, people who cherish their faith. And you may not come from such a background, but in the end, after studying this conflict in the Middle East and the parties that are involved, it came to broaden your mind and broaden your horizons and gave you a new respect for people. I'm just wondering if you could maybe expand on that a bit.
Yes, it's something that comes from the Syrian context in particular. As you mentioned, I'm not a religious person myself, but I went into Syria having heard of the idea, the very long tradition of secularism in Syria, but I came to realize that secularism in the Syrian context doesn't mean exactly the same as we think of secularism here. Secularism in Syria is really a way of talking about pluralism. It doesn't mean that the state does not have religious, doesn't support religion in different ways. So, of course, this tradition sort of varies in different countries. I know that it's different in the US to the way it is in Australia. It's different in Latin America. But in Syria, this idea of religious pluralism is really very well developed because it goes back many, many centuries. There may be a history to sectarianism in the Middle East, which goes back centuries. But in the Syrian context, there's a history to pluralism, which goes back many centuries. And it leads to some very surprising sorts of things. The fact that, for example, you have this coexistence of churches and mosques and a huge array of what someone once said to me, a beautiful rainbow of different communities in Syria. They really celebrate their plurality and the variety of peoples that live in Syria. And that has some surprising things in terms of the contributions of what I consider genuinely religious people, people that have very strong spiritual values to their culture. There's a lot of things we can learn from Syria, I believe, from this, you know, as opposed to the Islamists who are the tools of this current conflict. They're not really religious people in my sense, and Syria to me has helped me focus on that. That's not, they're not the extremists or the conservatives of the religious tradition, the Islamist terrorists and mercenaries. The real religious people, including conservative religious people, I think perhaps I'd always conflated conservatism with fundamentalism in the way I thought of religious people, but Syria made me see through someone like the late Sheikh al-Bouti, for example, that very conservative religious people could be very decent people defending very decent social values. That's what I meant to say.
Well, despite all the negative factors and forces that are involved, there are perhaps positive lessons we can take from the conflict, but I think it mainly centers around being more skeptical of what we're hearing in our own media. And you've done a bang-up job. This is a spectacular must-read book for everyone that has been or has not been following Syria. And we'll provide information and links on the internet as to where people can purchase this book. But this is a monumental effort. I thank you very much for writing this and for taking the time on the other side of the world, just getting up to give us this interview. So on behalf of our program, I just wanted to thank you very much for being here with us today.
Oh, thank you, Brendan. Thank you.